Okay, today is November 7th, 2012. This is the second interview with Kenneth Ken Shapiro. We're here again in Steenbach Library inside the UW-Madison Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Ken, as we did with the first interview, could you say your name and then spell your last name?
Yes, my name is Kenneth Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O.
Thank you. When we last left off, you were talking about a project you had that involved computer cards.
Well, this
and
was
I'm not sure whether we really got to finish that as well as I'd like, so okay. I wonder if you could maybe start with that.
Okay, this was my dissertation research while I was a graduate student at Stanford. I was in Tanzania, and there was a lot of intensive data collection. I had enumerators visiting farmers 3 days a week for an hour each visit, and it generated a lot of data, complete input-output data on their farming operations. My wife, bless her, was doing a lot of the coding of that data, and then we would mail these large data sheets to the capital, Dar es Salaam, where the Ministry of Finance was just essentially learning how to use its computer, and they were happy to learn on my data. So they entered the data for me and generated 150,000 computer punch cards. And therein lies a tale, because when I got back to Stanford, the computer cards were boxed up and waiting on a dock in Dar es Salaam to be shipped back to California. And waited and waited, and there was dock strikes, et cetera. And finally Stanford, thank goodness, said, well, we'll just pay the freight and have them airlifted to you. I was telling my wife about this. She asked me to be sure to mention the name of one of the farmers who sort of personified the hospitality that I mentioned. And his name was Herman Luliejo, L-U-L-Y-E-H-O. And Herman was considered the best farmer in the area, and in fact had won a national award for that, and had a large family, and had one daughter who had been married for some years and did not have any children. And when we met Herman, we were relatively newly married and had not planned to have any children, but because we didn't have any children, he sort of took my wife on as an adopted daughter. And we had a wonderful relationship with that family for the year and a half or so that we were there. And that, as I say, personified what a lot of the farmers, our relationship with a lot of the farmers, which was perhaps the best part of the time in Tanzania. Excuse me.
Ken, is there anything else that you perhaps reflected upon in between this week and last week, that particularly about this time prior to UW-Madison, anything else that you want to say about that before we shift?
Well, I think we talked at length about the time in Tanzania and how that was a very different graduate student research experience from what most students have now, very much on my own. Gamble that the Social Science Research Council and National Science Foundation took on someone who had no prior experience any place out of the country, much less in Africa. I had one name of one professor in University of Dar es Salaam. And from there, I made connections to the Ministry of Agriculture in the capital, and then they gave me a name up country in the area south of Lake Victoria. And I connected with that person, and from there on, had to find my own housing out in the area, et cetera. I mentioned about the lack of water, the lack of electricity, lack of telephones. The mail would come once a week if we were lucky. That was down in the town, little trading center, post office. We built a water tank to hold water that was piped up past our little house to a missionary hospital further up the hill. And we were able to tap into that and get the water collected there. The water was very dirty. We had to put some kind of compounds in to clean the water, et cetera. So it was very much a seat of the pants operation that I don't think many graduate students have this today. Mm-hmm. But more than that, it was spending over a year in the farming area, working closely with farmers and getting to know them, and having structured interviews with them and spending time out in their fields, looking at the crops, measuring the areas of their farms.
Thank you for that. So would you ask these farmers, did you have a script? So
yes.
Each farmer was asked the same?
Right. Okay. As I say, it was a sort of a structured interview. It wasn't this a questionnaire, yes, no, mm-hmm. more or less, but it was a series of questions trying to relate their farming operations with their background that might give hints as to what was then called modernization by the sociologists and anthropologists. So a series of questions about their education, their literacy, their migration history, their stage in the life cycle of the family life cycle, and what difference it make if they were a young couple starting out or if they were in the prime of their families with small children, older children, old people, et cetera. And that was part of the dissertation, was to link various measures of efficiency, as economists defined it, with various measures of modernization, as sociologists and anthropologists were defining it.
Okay. So you came back from last time, you said you came back in March of 71.
Right.
How long did it take since you came, after you came back, to really build the dissertation and get defended?
I spent a year at, well, came back in March and spent a little time on the East Coast with family, and then I guess by the summertime was back in at Stanford, and spent a year at Stanford, first waiting for and then getting all the computer cards back from Tanzania, and then doing the analysis of that data and writing up my dissertation. And those were the days when computers were not at your desktop, but that there was a big computer center at the Stanford campus, and most graduate students like myself couldn't afford machine time during the daylight. So we all were out there from about midnight to 3 a.m. running our computer cards at the cheap prices. So that was a lot of the activity. And I worked closely with, I mentioned, Bill Jones was my advisor, Peter Timmer, and Paniotopoulos, Yotopoulos, and Bruce Johnston were the four faculty members who I worked most closely with. And then in anthropology, I worked closely with Frank Cancian, C-A-N-C-I-A-N. And I remember talking with Frank about how noisy the data were. And he said, yes, you're dealing with real data, not the nice, neat theories that economists like to work on with all their assumptions. So I spent that year writing. And Stanford has a different way of doing dissertations and defense, in that you defend your thesis before you start the research. So you present all your theory and your literature review and your hypotheses and what you're going to do to a large committee and get their feedback. And if they approve, then you can go forward with it. And then there's no oral defense of the dissertation. It's all the written back and forth until your committee approves the written work. So, and the dissertation, as I said, was focused on these different measures of efficiency. I mentioned that one measure was written about a lot by Theodore Schultz, who was a Nobel laureate who got his PhD from Wisconsin. The other was what they call technical efficiency, and the leading writer there was Harvey Liebenstein from Harvard. And I was measuring both kinds of efficiency and then relating that to modernization to see whether we could see a link, whether the more modern so-called farmers were in fact more efficient. And there was sufficient linkage to be able to write some papers about it.
Okay.
But I think it's a theoretical topic that is not of all that much interest these days. And but it matched what I mentioned earlier. What interested me in economics was how individuals behaved.
Right. And
so that was following that.
So once the dissertation was approved, Were you thinking of postdoc work? Were you thinking directly, trying to directly get a position? How did that all go?
Okay, so I wanted to do a postdoc and applied for a postdoc to work on economic anthropology. Working with anthropologists who are interested in economic behavior. And that, as I say, followed that interest that I had even as an undergraduate. And was able to secure a postdoctoral fellowship from the Social Science Research Council again. And I was going to stay at Stanford to work with Frank Cancian, who was a good economic anthropologist. And so, in fact, that's where my wife and I decided we would stay. And I also had a job offer from Santa Clara University to teach in their agribusiness, or I guess it was the economics department. They wanted me to teach money and banking. And I had not applied for that, but Santa Clara used to come regularly around Stanford looking for people. And so they came and offered me that position. At the same time, my wife had been accepted into the Berkeley Department of Sociology to do PhD work. During that year that we were back, she had gone to San Jose State College. It's now, I guess, I don't know what they call it, but it's part of the University of California system at San Jose, and done a master's degree in sociology, and then applied and was accepted into the Berkeley Sociology program. So we were pretty well set to stay in California, and I was probably going to do the postdoc, but I also could have done that position at Santa Clara. She was going to go to Berkeley. And then University of Michigan contacted my advisor, who contacted me, and said, you really should look into this opening. And I was not terribly interested, but he convinced me that I should. And so I went out for an interview to Michigan. And this morning, my wife reminded me to let you know what she said as we were driving to the airport. It was late February, I believe. And she said, now look around and look at all the lovely trees and flower and how nice it is here in Palo Alto at the end of February. And tell me what you see when you get to Michigan. And of course, at Michigan, there was snow and ice on the ground, et cetera. And I remember talking with one of the faculty who interviewed me, the search committee, about that. And he said, Ken, you're too young to make your career choices based on the weather. And of course, the year after that, he left for Washington, D.C. So I don't know. It's not terribly interesting to historians, but it turns out that a few days before going to Michigan, I had been out hiking, and unbeknownst to me, I'd gotten involved with some poison oak, and so that I didn't realize it, but during my time at Michigan, my face was getting progressively redder and redder from the rash. And when I came back on the plane, my wife said, what is the matter? And so evidently, my bizarre appearance at Michigan did not deter them from offering me the position.
Mm-hmm. And what was the position at Michigan?
It was a tenure-track assistant professor. It was actually interesting. It was split half between what they call their School of Natural Resources and on one side, and then in the economics department, they had a center for research on economic development. So I had a 50-50 split, essentially teaching and doing little research under the School of Natural Resources, but the Center for Research on Economic Development was totally focused on research. So that was in 72, I guess. That would have been starting in September of 72.
Right, and so that's, so you were at Michigan for 11 years.
Right, okay. And you said about when getting my dissertation finally approved. In those days, things were a little looser, so I left Stanford without having finished my dissertation. I was on the verge of having finished it, and my advisors were happy to have me go off. They were confident it would get done promptly, and I had the Social Science Research Council postdoc, and that was an issue for me. I wanted to do that, so I told the folks at Michigan that, and they said, well, why don't you come to Ann Arbor and spend your postdoc year in Ann Arbor, and then you can start the assistant professor position in the following year. And I agreed to that because at Ann Arbor there was Marshall Sahlins, S-A-H-L-I-N-S, who was generally acknowledged as sort of the leading figure in economic anthropology. And Sahlins had just published a book called Stone Age Economics, sort of a revolutionary treatise putting together a lot of his career work on what he called primitive societies and the economic activities there. So I came to Michigan and got intensively involved with the anthropology group there and decided that I would expand my dissertation and write another large piece on sort of the biological background of cotton, which was a major crop in Tanzania. So I didn't finish my dissertation for another, I don't even know when it was done, but it was at least 6 months, if not longer, before. And at the same time, as I say, the SS, Social Science Research Council, was happy to support me with the postdoc. I don't know if they would allow that sort of relaxed attitude.
Now, did that additional chunk of the dissertation, did that require research? Did that require you going back to Africa, or was the research already done?
No, it was library research into the biological issues surrounding mostly cotton, but also cassava, two of the big crops in the area.
Okay.
And since I felt that I had the luxury of the time, I just did it there.
Okay. Now, we want to focus on your time at UW-Madison, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't, you know, touch on these, at least touch on these to some extent, these 11 years in Michigan.
Okay.
I'd sort of like to do it by how we will talk about your UW-Madison time, and that's talking about, you know, teaching, research, and then service.
Okay.
So maybe overviews of those. So let's start with an overview of your teaching experience at Michigan.
Okay, so that was after the year as a postdoc. Let me just say about Michigan that my reaction was that this was much more intensively intellectual than at Stanford. And I thought it was maybe because Stanford had so many other attractions to people. But my wife pointed out that as a postdoc, I was able to really laser in on things that interested me and the folks that it did. But it was a really exciting experience that first year. And then when I got to start on the assistant professor position, I think actually the semester before I formally started, I was asked to pick up a course in resource economics. And this was a field I was completely ignorant of. In fact, it was an emerging field that many people, not very many people, were working on. And because I really had been hired to teach about agricultural development and economic development. Okay. But the person who was scheduled to teach the resource economics, an older professor named Bob Gregory, had a heart attack. And there were two other resource economists, and they were otherwise occupied. And so I was thrown into that and managed to stay one chapter ahead of the students for the first semester. And that was a large class, and it was really good for me, allowing me to learn about resource economics. And it was sort of an upper division undergraduate course. So there were graduate students from the economics department who were looking for something in resource economics. This was the only course on the campus that was offered. And then there were graduate students and undergraduates in the School of Natural Resources, some coming out of the biological side who wanted to learn about economics, and some in resource economics in the School of Natural Resources. So I guess the class typically had about 75 students. I had two, maybe three teaching assistants, and I quite enjoyed it. So that was a consistent course. So even though I was at the start just filling in, I kept that course through the time that I was there. And then I also taught a course on agricultural development, essentially economic development, but focused on rural development issues. which I was well trained to do, and that was also a brand new domain at Michigan, so I was attracting students. Again, it was upper level undergraduates and masters and new PhD students. So I had students from the economics department and the School of Natural Resources in there. I taught that, I guess, just about every year. And then courses that I would do once or twice, I did a course on urban economics, largely because I was interested in the topic and was able to do that. I taught a course on sort of economic theory of production, and I taught a course on world food issues, world food problems. In the late 70s, that was the time of the drought in West Africa and desertification problems. And it was the time of the OPEC embargo, and fuel prices went up and food prices skyrocketed, so everyone was concerned about the world food situation. And that's a course that I continued to teach when I got to Wisconsin. So that's on the teaching side. On the research side, I continued to focus on efficiency that I had done in my dissertation and wrote some pieces on that. And then at the center, there was a focus on French West Africa. So I had done my dissertation work in Tanzania and the center. And the reason the center was so interested in me was because I had the African experience, and the center was building up an African capability. So the year that I was hired, I joined a group of four other young faculty and postdocs, and that was terrific. They were all focused on Africa, and I'll name them off. Peter Heller, who had just done his PhD at Harvard, was working on sort of financial issues in Kenya. Howard Elliott, who was just finishing his dissertation from Princeton with another Nobel laureate, W.A. Lewis, had done his work in the Congo. Peter Mook, who just finished his degree at Columbia, also with a Nobel laureate, Becker. He was working in Kenya. And his wife, who had just finished her dissertation in anthropology at Columbia, working also in Kenya. So the five of us were sort of bonded and had a great time, both professionally and socially. So that was a wonderful group to come into. And at the center, the leader of the center was Elliot Berg, who was considered one of the leaders in economics development in Africa, went on to write sort of a landmark piece for the World Bank that changed the bank's lending operations in ways that some of us were not happy about, but he was a major influence. So that was the group of young people, and Elliot and some of the more senior folks, Wolfgang Stolper, were there. And so the research I was doing was initially the efficiency work, sort of elaborating on that, writing on that. And then under the center's push to work on French West Africa, and as an indication of how the money used to flow in the 70s, I had some French training, actually, as a graduate student. Back in those days, you had to do either two languages or a language and advanced mathematics. Yeah. So I had done the one language and the advanced math, and the language I did was French. And it was just a semester, maybe it was a year, cramming and then taking the qualifying exam. And at Michigan, they said, well, you need more than that. So they funded me and my wife to spend the summer in France to improve our French.
Wow.
So that's an indication of how, you know, the funding was available to do this. Not just me, but the both of us. So we spent a delightful summer. I guess it was summer of 73 or 74. Maybe it was 74. I just moved there at the summer of 72 and finished the postdoc in summer of 73 and then 74. Okay. In Vichy, the city of Vichy, V-I-C-H-Y, and that was an anniversary of the landings of the Allies or something, and so there was a lot of World War II in the air, and of course Vichy was the headquarters of the Vichy regime in France, and we took our meals with a landlady who lived through that, and a lot of talk, some of which I could understand in French at the dinner table about all that. So that was very nice. Then came back and started to do work in French West Africa, and two major blocks of the research. One was on the livestock economies of French West Africa. In that area, livestock are raised close to the Sahara in what's called the Sahel. And so that's parts of Mali, Niger, and Upper Volta. And then the markets for the meat are closer to the coast, where there's more money in the big cities down in Abidjan and Lagos, et cetera. So I had squadrons of graduate students out in the field looking at the production economies up in the Sahel, the mixed livestock grain production systems, and then some graduate students down in the coastal countries looking at how the retail trade worked, and then had students who would actually get on the train with herds of cattle and follow them down. It was about 1,000 miles, I guess. So I was able to give them the same kind of experience that I had in Tanzania, that year-long detailed work with the farmers, or in this case, the traders. So, and a lot of the work was just trying to figure out how all that that economy and that trade worked, and also then picking up on some of my earlier interests in economic behavior, seeing what we could learn about the economic rationality of the pastoralists, because there was always this talk that, well, these pastoralists, they just try to acquire as many animals as possible because they love the animals, and they're not really operating with any economic rationality. And we were able to gather the data about the costs and returns of acquiring, keeping, and then selling animals, and we're able to show that they're operating in a very rational, profit-maximizing way. How long they kept the animals, when they sold them, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that was part of that. And then the other big block of work was on the grain economies of that part of the world, looking at farmers' production and especially their sales behavior. Because you've got the paradox of farmers growing their grain, which they need for their own subsistence. And if they have any surplus, they would sell it right away, right after the harvest, when everyone was selling grain and prices were very low. And then they would run short of grain before the next harvest, and they would have to buy back grain from the market, or they would have to go into debt to buy back grain. So we were trying to document that behavior and try to figure out why they were doing this and who was doing it. And in fact, we found that much of the larger farmers were able to hold back and take advantage of the big price swings just before the harvest. And it was the small farmers who just kept getting driven further and further into debt, because as soon as they would get any surplus, they would sell, because they had cash needs either to pay back the old debt that they had, or because there was pent-up demand that the kids needed school fees, uniforms, et cetera. So I counted up, there were about 14 graduate students that I had in those years, most of them PhD students and some master students.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a source of dissatisfaction. That what I enjoyed about my research was being in the field and working with the farmers, but the new role as an assistant professor was sending graduate students to do that. And I never really felt ownership of the projects or the data. You know, I did own it. I was the PI, and I raised the money, and I got the grants, mm-hmm. and they were my students. But they were the ones who gathered it. They were the ones who knew what the data meant, and they were the ones who talked to the farmers. So it was very much an arm's length process that wasn't all that satisfactory.
So it wasn't the students themselves, it was...
No, students were great.
Is that you were now detached enough yeah. from it that...
Yeah, you know, students wound up, you know, teaching at Michigan State, joining this International Food Policy Research Institute, going to World Bank, et cetera. So they were good students.
How many, or if you just sort of quickly talk about publications that came from this, what sort of publications, if any,
So there were a few articles, but mostly they were sort of book-length monographs, and they were published by the center. So there were three. This was the first livestock study generated five book-length monographs, one that I wrote and four that graduate students wrote, and then the there was a second livestock study that had three or four monographs, and I just contributed a few chapters to that. And then the grain studies, I think there were two collections of sort of novellas, you know, not quite book length, mm-hmm. but students. And one cost of coming to Wisconsin was that the first big study, the livestock study, I pulled together pieces from four of the graduate students in my own work, and we had gotten an agreement with a publishing firm called Heinemann Publishing to produce it as a book. And then I came to Wisconsin, and my students took their jobs, and we just never did the work to convert it into a book, which was too bad.
Can you now talk about service to the UW-Michigan.
Yeah. Right. So, So in the School of Natural Resources, I was, after a few years, the director of the Resource Economics Program for the campus, which was small because Resource Economics was in its infancy, at least at Michigan, and so it was a joint program with the School of Natural Resources and the Department of Economics. And that was simply coordinating a few courses and encouraging students to follow the program. I directed the school's international activities. There were a series of international fellowships. We were getting a stream of international students coming in, and I was made responsible for that. We put together a summer course funded by the Department of Interior to bring people from around the world who were looking at resource issues in their countries, in developing countries, to give them a summer's worth of intensive economics to bolster their sort of mid-professional training. So one other professor, Gunter Schramm, S-C-H-R-A-M-M, and I ran that course for about 5 or 6 years, I guess. And then what was the most interesting was that toward the end, I was asked to be the acting director of the Center for Research and Economic Development. The director was off on sabbatical. And that was most enjoyable and quite successful. So we put together some big grants that we received. And I found that I really enjoyed putting together those programs and reaching across disciplines, and that's what led me to Wisconsin.
Okay. Again, not to gloss over this period in Michigan, mm-hmm. so I want to make sure if there's anything else you want to say about your time there.
I did some major consulting work in mostly, I guess it was all in Africa, for AID, for the World Bank, for some private firms. It was a 9-month appointment, and I every summer had full amount of summer funding, so it amounted to 12 months. I received tenure at Michigan, and again, that was a very different process. There was absolutely no preparation on my part. I was just called into the dean's office one day and congratulated, and that was it.
Let's see. Wow.
This one. Yeah, so they handle things very differently.
Okay. Well, let's shift for the rest of the time today and get us at least started at your time at UW.
Okay.
So, do you recall how either you found out about the job? Well, yeah, let's just start there with how you found out about the position.
So, in those days, and I think even till today, there's a publication called JOE, Job Openings for Economists. And now it's electronic, and you have to pull it down. But in those days, it was a print, and it came automatically with your membership in the American Economics Association. So it would come, you know, quarterly, I guess. And so I would leaf through it, and my wife would leaf through it to see what was out there. And there was one issue that had openings at Wisconsin and University of California, Davis, for two similar types of jobs, working in agricultural development as a faculty member, and as well taking a major administrative responsibility for developing programs. So we sort of looked at each other and said, well, might as well see what that's about, and if we're ever going to make a move, we should think about doing it when the kids are young, so that it's easier to do. And so I wrote off to both places and was asked to interview at both places and was offered a position at both places. And the Wisconsin position was more interesting. The administrative structure was, I thought, a stronger base for me to work on. And the department here had a much stronger reputation for international development. Another attraction of coming either to Wisconsin or to Davis was agriculture. Michigan was great, but I was it as far as agriculture was concerned at University of Michigan. There was no, and in fact, I used to receive the mail that would come blindly into the university for the School of Agriculture. So I was the only one on campus who had any affiliation that way. So it seemed a good opportunity to combine sort of the work that I had been doing as a faculty member, but to actually spend much more time, the majority of my time, doing the putting together of programs, which I enjoyed so much at Michigan. And Leo Walsh was the dean, and he offered me the position. And I remember negotiating with Leo. I don't know if you know Leo. Did you do an oral history with him?
I did not. I don't know if we have or not.
That's too bad. I hope you do. And so we were sort of arm wrestling about the last $1,000 of the offer. And I remember Leo said, now, Ken, this is really silly because, you know, once you're here, you'll be getting raises. You know, we've had a history of raises of 5-6% every year, and that swamps what we're talking about now. And of course, we never saw anything like that after I was hired. And I remind Leo of that every time I see him. I also told Leo that if he hired me, he'd be getting not just a professor, an associate dean, but a husband and a father, and I had my two little kids, and he was quite comfortable with that. And I remember after I accepted a position, I have brought my wife and our two kids to come meet him in his very dignified office. And I remember my son, who was about to be in kindergarten, somehow wound up on the floor under the table. But that was okay. So I was offered the position, 75% as associate dean for international programs in the college, and 25% and tenure track, and therein lies the tale, in the Department of Agricultural Economics, which is now called Agricultural and Applied Economics. So after I was offered the position, verbally, then Leo said, and of course, this is contingent on your getting tenure. I said, well, that's no problem, because I already have tenure at Michigan. He said, oh, no, you still have to get tenure at Wisconsin, which I thought was quite amusing. Again, I didn't do any of the preparation. I guess Leo or someone in the department put together the documentation. And they went out for letters to people, leading people in the field. And then they came back to me and said, we got a problem. All these people we asked for letters are people that you've worked with. And it was a problem because the field was relatively small and I had worked at Stanford, at Michigan, and because Michigan is close to Michigan State, I had also worked with some of those folks. So I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. Why don't you just send my dossier to some people here at the university who I don't know and let them figure out. And so that's what they did. So that I think Crawford Young was one of the letter writers and somebody in economics, et cetera. So I got my second tenure. And you know, that's how they do when you're hired in with tenure. You get a letter that's a contingent offer upon getting tenure. And it was at the full professor level.
So you talked a little bit about the stated expectations, 75% associate dean, 25% in ag economics.
Right.
Why don't we talk about the sort of the social aspects? You know, you now have a couple of kids, so moving to Madison and getting set up here.
Yeah. So I can't quite reconstruct the arrangement, but somehow I worked at both places for, I think, a year. It might have been just a semester. So I was commuting back and forth. And the family was still in Ann Arbor. And I was able to get one of those little apartments in university houses. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there, and occasionally Mimi, my wife, and the two kids, Maggie and Daniel, would come out. And but most of the time I would come and spend a week here and then be back in Ann Arbor and spend a few weeks there and then come out here. So that's about an 8-hour commute, which was not much fun. And I know it was during the winter as well, because I remember doing it in a driving snowstorm. So that was how I got started here. And during that time, we were looking for a house. And Dan Bromley was the department chair. And he and his wife lived in Sherwood Hills. And they encouraged us to look there. And we did. And because I had been coming back and forth so many times, I was looking and looking and never finding anything satisfactory. So finally, my wife came out. The next day, called me up and said, okay, I found the house. Now you come out here and buy it. we bought a house in Sherwood, where we've been living ever since 30 years now.
How, I guess not to put words in your mouth from other people, I guess, but how do you, or what do you know about the adjustment that your wife and kids made to being here in Madison?
Well, my wife, I should say that when we were at Michigan, I told you she had been accepted at Berkeley in the sociology department for a PhD, and so she then turned around and applied to Michigan and was accepted in the Michigan sociology PhD program and did all of her coursework, you know, taking time off to have a couple of kids, et cetera. And did all of her coursework and got started on her dissertation, and then came here and decided that she wanted to focus on getting the family, especially the kids, adjusted. So she put it down. And then trying to do the dissertation at a distance, and it didn't work. So she didn't finish, and at the same time she was asked to do some work as a consultant and then be hired to do some work, some medical sociology work, looking at how we educate young mothers about various risks of childhood, and then looking at the Native American population and a major study on infant mortality in that population. So she was sort of off and running as a practicing sociologist without finishing the dissertation, which I think that, well, it's too bad she didn't get to finish it, but it just became impossible with raising the kids and being at a distance from Michigan and then picking up those very interesting opportunities to practice. So that's, you know, part of the adjustment. The kids were just starting school. I guess my son was, I don't know if it was, maybe he was starting first grade and my daughter in third grade. Mm-hmm. And the Shorewood School is just a joy because it's such an international school. You know, English is one of 50 languages or so that's spoken in the school, and native-born American kids are the minority in the school, and so they had a wonderful, diverse set of friends, and which they enjoyed and we enjoyed, and so it was a good adjustment. And we never were that enamored of Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor in those days was a little burg, at least in our eyes, coming from the East Coast and from the Bay Area. And Madison was a bigger place, and Madison wasn't much of a place, but I remember Ann Arbor, the only serious shopping, the big store, was a Sears Roebuck store in downtown Ann Arbor. There were no shopping centers and et cetera. Mm. And of course, Madison, this was before the new airport, so there was, you'd walk off the plane onto the tarmac, and it was a different place back then.
So how about your professional adjustment then to Madison?
I think that went relatively smoothly. in the majority part of my appointment was with in the dean's office as associate dean for international programs, and Leo Walsh and I really saw eye to eye on how I would operate, which was what I would say, vigorously or aggressively going after extramural funding, and with a focus initially on Africa. And that was right up my alley. And I was blessed with a really good staff. I had a staff of five people, mostly on soft money from, those were the days when AID had what they called strengthening grants to strengthen international programs in colleges of agriculture. So I walked into that happy situation. Subsequently, I had to go after lots of money to continue the soft money funding of that staff. And let me just name the names. The associate director in my office was Jane Knowles, K-N-O-W-L-E-S. And then there was Nancy Fox, Sharon Baumgartner, Lynn Nelson, and Loretta Erdahl. And there was a good staff, and we're still good friends. And I just last month received the college's Distinguished Service Award and had all those staff members and others come to the banquet dinner. And we still get together a couple of times a year. And that was the big part of the professional adjustment on that side, that I treated them as my equals. They knew more than I did about this place, and we would have lunch together just about every day, and we would have substantive meetings like every other week, and they were all expected to chime in as to where we should be going and opportunities. So,
So that was
in the dean's office.
That's
the
dean's,
was,
yeah. That's
was
the dean's
in
office,
the department, and there I was given the freedom to do very little teaching. So initially, I was just teaching a course on for students to help get them started writing the dissertations, and showing them models of good dissertations and talking with them about their dissertation ideas. The department was the mainstay of the Land Tenure Center, and so there are a number of faculty connected with the Land Tenure Center, and that was the strength of the department in economic development. So Peter Dorner, Bill Thiessen Hughes and John Strasmer were the three main development folks, and they were very glad to have me. All three of them had their focus in Latin America, so they were glad to have someone working on Africa, and I quickly acquired a couple of PhD students who were working on Africa, and glad to have as an advisor someone who knew the continent.
So it sounds like your initial time was pretty smooth.
Yeah, I would say so.
I think I want to ask maybe just one more thing. Mm-hmm. I have to admit my mind's trying to waver a bit from the late night of watching the
yes.
election results.
Okay.
the one thing I do want to ask is, you've already talked about tenure, you've talked about teaching load, at least for this initial period. Yeah. What was campus like, particularly, you know, as you sort of look through it in your 2012 eyes, what did it look like in the mid-80s?
This was before biotechnology was upon us, but still, say, at least in the college, the biochemistry department was the leading department in the college. I was very proud after, I think it was 91 or 92, the numbers came out that showed that my office generated more indirect costs than the biochemistry department. That was a good marker, but that's an indication of how important that department was back in 82, 83, and mm-hmm. it's continued to be that important. Campus international activities, there was an international dean. Pete Dorner at one point became that dean. I'm trying to think about the campus had a relationship with a university in Germany, and I was asked to do some hosting for that. But there was not very much, at least certainly in the college, there was no study abroad activities, no international student exchange. There had been a period in the 60s and early 70s of what they called institution building, when this campus got heavily involved in building up universities in Brazil, in Indonesia, and in Nigeria. And so that sort of echoed still into my time. People thought about international activities as those big blockbuster where you had maybe 10 faculty members from campus living in one of those countries for 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. while junior faculty from those institutions would be here to get their PhDs. And in fact, we have one booklet showing the Nigerian experience, showing the faculty in Nigeria with a bunch of white faces, which were Wisconsin faculty, and then 10 years later with a bunch of black faces, which were the Nigerian mm-hmm. students who had come here for their PhDs and gone back to assume those positions. So that's how the thinking had been. And Wisconsin was at that time linked into a consortium called the Midwest University Consortium for International Activities, which was essentially the Big Ten universities. And some of those institution building projects were under the umbrella of that consortium. In terms of the physical layout of the campus, you know, we didn't have all these modern bioscience buildings and luxury dormitories, but it's basically the same place.
Okay.
A lot prettier than I thought, a lot prettier, the whole town and the campus, than Michigan, which was, you know, flat and without the water and such.
Okay.
So.
And one more thing. So you had an office in Bascom under the provost?
No, it was in Ag Hall, okay. under the dean's office.
Okay, so yeah. you were in Ag. You just had one office in Ag Hall.
Right, and then I had an office in Ag Econ.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So I gave two that offices. Up after about okay. 5 years.
Okay, got it. Anything else you want to say about this early years that you, either you have written down or it might be on your mind right now, and you want to make sure we get it on the record?
Well, I think maybe next time we'll talk about getting off to a pretty fast start with extramural grants and
okay.
programs like that.
I think that's all right.
Beyond
then,
that, in the early days, I I guess, you know, one thing was going around and meeting the different department chairs and getting some exposure to the different departments and trying to comprehend just what the agronomy department did, different from the soils department. Since when I was an undergraduate at Cornell, they were combined. And why did we have a plant pathology department and an entomology department and a horticulture department? And what did they do? And, so getting to know the non-economics faculty.
Okay. All right. Well, Ken, I want to thank you for your
time
this morning. I appreciate it.